who demanded an explanation for the motives behind the payments.
It proved a thorny problem,
as the stories concocted by Warner, something about unspecified work conducted between 2005 and 2010, failed to convince the banks. The wires were for legitimate services. There was simply no proof of any such work having been done. Even as he quietly struggled behind the scenes to convince the banks to let Bin Hammam's money through, Warner made one of the biggest decisions of his life. In a letter sent to FIFA dated June 17, 2011, Warner resigned from all positions in international soccer. 3 days later, FIFA made the news public with a brief statement noting that it had accepted Warner's offer of resignation and thanking the Trinidadian for his service to the game. As a consequence of Mr. Warner's self-determined resignation, all ethics committee procedures against him have been closed, FIFA wrote in the statement. The presumption of innocence is maintained. In his resignation letter, Warner had reaffirmed what he called his offer of cooperation with the FIFA Ethics Committee in its ongoing probe of Bin Hammam. But Free's investigators found that proved very far from the truth. The only stick FIFA had to compel cooperation from its officials was the threat of sanction. With Warner not only out of soccer but completely exonerated, the organization's investigation couldn't touch him. Warner said as much in public, telling a reporter he would die first before helping with an investigation that was initiated by Chuck Blazer, his oldest and closest partner, who in the space of a few weeks had become his greatest nemesis. I'm not going to back a complaint made by an American and investigated by Americans and an attempt to put it on American soil, Warner defiantly added. A few days later, he wrote an email to Free's lead investigator on the case, stating that he would not help the probe and adding that he had proof that there was a transatlantic cabal within FIFA bent on destroying him. Following Warner's resignation from CONCACAF, Lyle Austin, a Barbadian who had been on the Confederation's executive committee since the late 1970s, was the most senior vice president, and by statute next in line for the presidency. But when he tried to assume the post, he met resistance, particularly from Blazer, who instead arranged to name another CONCACAF vice president, Honduran Alfredo Howitt, to the position. Austin responded by attempting to fire Blazer, but the general secretary refused to go. Austin quickly hired American lawyers, who in turn retained a corporate investigations firm called FTI Consulting to conduct a forensic review of the Confederation's finances. But after FTI employees were repeatedly denied entry to Trump Tower and CONCACAF's Miami offices, the lead on the case, a Miami-based investigator named Simon Strong, was handed a different assignment. Dig up dirt on Chuck Blazer. So Strong, a tall, slender Englishman with blue eyes and a cool, unassuming manner that made some people think he might be a spy, began what people in his line of work called developing information, which translated to calling around, working contacts, and asking favors. He spoke to Jack Warner, asked Lyle Austin for contacts, and flew around the Caribbean to meet with current and former CFU officials and employees, some of whom had left the organization as soon as Warner was suspended. Although Austin hadn't been at the infamous meeting in Port of Spain, most CFU officials had, and many quite happily pocketed the $40,000. From where they stood, FIFA's ruling wasn't just an attack on Jack Warner, who had led and empowered them for so many years. It also felt like a direct and very personal threat to their own lifestyles. Blazer's subsequent attempt to override CONCACAF bylaws and prevent Austin from becoming interim president only underscored those feelings. To them, it felt like a coup d'etat. It was perhaps no surprise, then, that Strong was able, in relatively short order, to root out a considerable trove of documents shining a light on Blazer. The meaning of some of the documents had been explained to Strong by the sources who had handed them over, while others had less obvious connotations, but collectively they painted the picture of a man who had been taking in great sums of money that nobody knew anything about. Strong had the distinct feeling there was a lot more to be had as well. In the weeks since Warner's ouster, Blazer had worked hard to portray himself as a pillar of rectitude and transparency. telling one journalist, "We don't tolerate the type of behavior that was manifested by senior members of the Confederation." But in fact, nobody had anything close to a clear picture of what Blazer, who served as CONCACAF's treasurer as well as its general secretary, was up to. For one thing, he never showed the Confederation's books to anyone, guarding them more closely than a private diary. There was no sense, no matter how vague, of how well he had been managing CONCACAF for all these years, and nobody seemed to have the foggiest notion of how much money he was making. Indeed, the topic of his income had only been so much as mentioned within the organization 3 times over the previous 20 years. The last time it was brought up was in 2002, when Blazer brushed off a query about nearly $1.2 million in commissions that were being booked as a marketing expense. The question had been asked by a delegate before the entire CONCACAF Congress, and Blazer had been forced to acknowledge that the payments were, in fact, part of his compensation. But his public comments somehow failed to appear in the official minutes of the meeting, and were soon forgotten. What Strong had dug up, however, suggested that Blazer had been raking in millions of dollars over many years, and most of it had never been declared. That much was clear from his original 1990 contract, with its clause entitling Blazer to 10% commissions on all sponsorship and TV rights fees, which amounted to nearly all of CONCACAF's revenue. But that was hardly everything. Among the documents Strong had procured was a letter Jack Warner sent to Republic Bank in Trinidad on March 31st, just a few months earlier, instructing it to draft a check for $250,000 to Blazer. Strong also had a copy of the canceled check for that amount, which had been deposited in a bank account in the Bahamas on May 3rd, immediately following the CONCACAF Congress in Miami. That $250,000 payment clearly wasn't sponsorship or television rights fees. It also wasn't at all clear why Blazer had accounts in tax havens like the Bahamas, and why he used shell companies, rather than his own name, on the vast majority of his financial documents. The 10% contract was between CONCACAF and some entity called Sportvertising. And other documents in Strong's possession showed that the company, originally incorporated in New York State, had since been registered in the Cayman Islands, where companies are not subject to corporate tax, and ownership disclosures are extremely minimal. At the very least, Strong thought, the documents suggested an aggressive tax avoidance strategy, though it was far from clear where all the money was coming from. Before moving to Miami, Strong had been a reporter, working for newspapers on London's Fleet Street and then in Australia. Eventually, he moved to South America, where he was a foreign correspondent for a few British dailies. He wrote a book on communist guerrillas in Peru, and a few years later, a second book that was one of the first serious examinations of the career of Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar. The book focused especially on money laundering, and Strong was familiar with the many ways crooks use offshore accounts to clean up dirty cash. Although he had given up on journalism, Strong maintained extensive contacts with journalists throughout Latin America and the UK. He was also a soccer fan, having grown up supporting Burnley Football Club. Like the millions of other people around the planet who followed the sport, he felt a sense of outrage when he thought about the way the people's game had been exploited by unscrupulous officials who milked it for every penny they could. Chuck Blazer, it was plain to see, was one of those officials. And fans ought to be able to read about what he had been up to in black and white. Strong could think of at least one British journalist who felt the same way. The first of Andrew Jennings's articles about Chuck Blazer's finances was buried on page 13 of the July 17, 2011 edition of the Sunday Herald, a Scottish daily with a circulation around 25,000. At the same time, Jennings posted the article on his own website, Transparency in Sport, adding links to some of the documents and the cheeky headline, "Lucky Chucky, Blazer Takes Secret 10% on Sponsor Deals." The story, barely 500 words long, was classic Jennings, jammed full with explosive facts and liberally salted with arch comments and sarcasm. It contained the first public mention of Sportvertising, and Blazer's unusual contract with CONCACAF which allowed him to be paid millions in commissions. It also described Warner's $250,000 request for a check to be sent to Blazer the previous March, but offered no theories about what the payment could have been for. 2 days prior to publication, Blazer responded to a series of emailed questions from Jennings, acknowledging the 10% commission, but arguing that the payments were consistent with industry standards. As for the $250,000 check, Blazer explained, "It was repayment of a personal loan advanced by me to Jack Warner over 5 years ago." Hours after publication, Blazer wrote Jennings again, taking issue with the reporter's descriptions of his physical size, which he said was irrelevant to his job, as well as his characterization of the commissions as secret. "Find another villain," Blazer angrily wrote. "I am not your guy." Part of Jennings' revelation was mentioned in a New York Times story on the exorbitant lifestyles of FIFA officials, but otherwise it landed with little notice. The sporting press seemed more interested in the continued fallout from Port of Spain. FIFA's investigation into the event had been completed in early July, and a series of leaks out of Zurich about the findings dominated the headlines. On July 23, 2011, FIFA banned Bin Hammam from soccer for life, while Jason Sylvester and Debbie Mengel, who had handed out the cash in the Hyatt Regency boardroom, were given year-long bans from the sport. Bin Hammam had honored his deal with Warner, finally finding a small bank in Trinidad that would accept the rationale that his transfer of $1.2 million was for professional services provided over the period 2005 to 2010. And Warner, in turn, had dutifully kept his mouth closed. Then on August 9th, the FIFA Ethics Committee turned to Lyle Austin, banning him from the sport for a year because he had filed suit to resolve his ongoing dispute with CONCACAF. Officials in Zurich had been aghast at his move, which threatened FIFA's deep-seated belief that it was a higher power above any meddling from sovereign nations. That same day, Jennings wrote Blazer again, telling him that more information has come to hand, and laying out 20 detailed questions about his financial affairs, assets, and compensation. The reporter's sources in Miami and the Caribbean had sent him another pile of documents. He demanded to learn the story behind a $205,000 check from late the previous summer, as well as wire instructions for a $57,500 payment to Sportvertising from 1996. He also asked whether it was true that Blazer's son, an athletic trainer, received a $7,000 a month salary from CONCACAF, and if Blazer was the owner of several luxury condominiums in the Bahamas. Although in prior communications Jennings had been silent on the issue, this time he inquired repeatedly about Blazer's tax situation. "Are you confident," Jennings wondered, "that all offshore payments and benefits to you have been reported to the IRS?" Throughout his lengthy career, Jennings had rarely held down a staff job at any publication. He wrote in bursts, was known to be prickly when it came to editing, and his monomaniacal focus on a single topic for years at a time seemed best suited to the freelance life. Although he was held up as an icon by some journalists, he had suffered more than a few falling outs with others. He was, in other words, always on the lookout for a steady paycheck. This time around, the article found a home in the Sunday edition of The Independent, published in London. Before it went to press, Jennings called Jared Randall at the FBI to let him know that he had in his possession what he believed were important papers. The two talked frequently, and Randall said he'd be happy to take a look. Jennings emailed over his whole cache. There was no way for him to know what the FBI thought of the documents, but Jennings used the mere fact that Randall had received them as evidence that the agency was in fact looking into their contents. "FBI investigates secret payments to FIFA whistleblower," read the headline, on page 10 of the Independent's August 13th edition. The man credited with blowing the whistle on bribery and corruption in FIFA, the body that runs world football, is now himself the subject of an FBI inquiry, the article began. U.S. investigators are examining documents appearing to show confidential payments to offshore accounts operated by an American FIFA official, Chuck Blazer. Once again, Jennings posted the story to his website, adding photos of Blazer, his son, his girlfriend, and links to several of the underlying documents. This time, however, the online story ran more than twice as long as the version in The Independent, and included multiple denials of impropriety by Blazer, who claimed the transactions were not income items nor subject to tax. 3 days later, August 16, 2011, the story was picked up by a reporter at the newswire Reuters, which places stories in thousands of newspapers and websites around the world every day. The journalist, a seasoned investigative hand in Reuters' Washington, D.C. office, named Mark Hosenball, repeated much of Jennings' story and added a few additional details. A New York-based FBI squad assigned to investigate Eurasian organized crime is examining evidence related to payments made to Chuck Blazer, Hosenball reported, noting that he had personally reviewed all the documents. The two reporters were old friends, and in an unusual show of generosity in the competitive news business, Hosenball credited both The Independent and Jennings, helpfully providing the web address where the British journalist's full article could be found. Google's news alerts picked up the Reuters story as soon as it was published, dropping it automatically into inboxes around the globe, including one belonging to a particularly avid soccer fan with a keen interest in criminal tax law in faraway Orange County, California. Chapter 9. RICO. The story of Elliot Ness's pursuit of Al Capone, the most powerful and feared gangster in America during Prohibition, is a classic of the true crime genre. Ness, a dashing young G-man, along with his incorruptible team of untouchables, did what nobody else could, fearlessly raiding Capone's bootlegging operation until Scarface was brought to his knees. This version is, however, largely a fiction. The true hero behind Capone's fall was a stout, cigar-puffing, nearsighted business school dropout from Buffalo named Frank J. Wilson, who was an agent for the Treasury Department's intelligence unit. Assigned to the Capone case in 1927, Wilson moved from Baltimore to Chicago and spent most of the next 4 years holed up on the fourth floor of an old post office building, complaining of questionable persons hanging around the halls, as he tirelessly reviewed reams of documents. Eventually, he unearthed several ledgers showing Capone had unreported income, used handwriting analysis to identify their author, then went undercover in Miami to track that man down and convince him to testify against the mobster in court. From there, Wilson and his team of special agents methodically built the most famous tax evasion case in history, leading to Capone's conviction in 1931, which sent the gangster to prison for 11 years. Wilson went on to play a key role in solving the Lindbergh kidnapping, and later headed the Secret Service, where he vastly reduced counterfeiting in America. In 1978, the Treasury's intelligence unit was rechristened IRS Criminal Investigation. Within IRSCI, as agents called the division, Wilson was a source of institutional pride, embodying the virtues of an agency that never seemed to get the attention or credit that other law enforcement agencies, chiefly the FBI, did. Wilson, the intelligence unit's chief once admiringly remarked, is a genius for details. Wilson fears nothing that walks. He will sit quietly looking at books 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, forever, if he wants to find something in those books. Steve Berryman joined the IRS when he was 23 years old and, other than a few summer jobs in bookstores during high school, had never worked anywhere else. He believed that IRS agents had unique tools and training at their disposal that nobody else did. Like other federal law enforcement, IRS agents carry a badge and gun, can make arrests, and serve warrants. But their greatest power, Berryman felt, was the ability to digest complicated financial records, converting endless rows of numbers into powerful narratives of lawlessness. "We do," Berryman was fond of saying to anyone who would listen, "the financial shit nobody else wants to touch." After more than 20 years on the job, Berryman had become focused almost entirely on complex international cases. In recent years, he'd helped win convictions in cases involving a pair of Hollywood producers who had been paying kickbacks to officials in Thailand so that they could manage an annual film festival in the country, and a Riverside County, California company whose executives had bribed officials at the UK Ministry of Defense to win equipment contracts. More recently, he'd been looking into several Israeli banks that hadn't complied with reporting laws and seemed to be covering up international tax evasion. The cases were interesting. Berryman got to travel abroad and experiment with different ways to apply little-known aspects of the law. But they were also relatively contained, focusing on one or two defendants, and he ached to try something really big, with many defendants, that would truly put his sleuthing skills to the test. What he longed for was a very specific type of investigation, one that the IRS wasn't particularly known for working, and that he himself had never had a chance to try. It was still morning when Berryman stepped out of his Soho hotel, but already it was uncomfortably warm, the beginning of one of those sticky days in New York when it feels like summer's oppressive heat will never end. It was mid-September 2011, and the IRS agent hadn't set foot in New York in 16 years. His government-issued cell phone didn't have a map function, so he had stopped at a drugstore the previous day to buy a folding laminated map of the city. Feeling stuffy in a suit and tie, Berryman peered down at the map from time to time as he crossed Canal Street, cut through Chinatown, and passed the city's various courthouses to 26 Federal Plaza, where he rode up to the 23rd floor. Jared Randall greeted him at the elevator bank, escorting him to briefly meet Mike Gaeta before leading him into a small conference room. Berryman was surprised at how young the FBI agent was, and as he laid out his theory for a soccer case, Randall sat quietly eyeing him. "You don't know me from Adam," Berryman said, "but I've been doing this kind of thing for a very long time." "I know who you are," Randall replied. It was awkward for Berryman, a veteran used to picking and choosing cases as he pleased. He was the guy FBI agents and prosecutors called asking for help on tough cases. Yet now he was trying to sell himself to someone who looked like he'd just left the academy. In the week since he'd gotten the Google alert containing the Reuters article about Blazer, Berryman had gathered enough material to talk for hours. Sepp Blatter, Mohammed bin Hammam, Jack Warner. He could recite the names of most of FIFA's executive committee members from memory. Referring to a bullet point outline he'd typed up, Berryman reeled off names of soccer officials he thought could be targets, of others he'd like to interview as witnesses, and of specific criminal statutes he thought might have been violated. As he talked, he could see a faint smile flicker across the FBI agent's face. Berryman suspected he was on the right track, and shifted gears, telling Randall about some of the cases he'd done in the past. But just as he got going, Randall interrupted him, leaning back in his chair with a quick laugh. "Yeah," he said, "you seem like the right guy for this." Berryman felt a wave of relief. "Great," he replied, then said something he'd carefully rehearsed ahead of time. "Can you please contact your prosecutor and let him know I'd like to meet him?" "Oh, I already talked to him about you," Randall said, adding that they could head over to Brooklyn after lunch. As far as Berryman could tell, the people who controlled soccer weren't murderers, kidnappers, or drug dealers. They were sports bureaucrats, aging men in fancy suits, tippling champagne in the VIP box at the World Cup. But without a doubt, they were all bound together by a single organization, FIFA, which felt to him like the very definition of an enterprise as defined by the Federal RICO statute. Under the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, large numbers of people can be charged en masse for crimes stretching back years or even decades, provided it can be shown they took place as part of a pattern of racketeering activity, that at least two people were involved in the scheme, and that the most recent crime took place within 10 years of the prior crime. Under RICO, one needn't have directly committed the criminal act to be convicted for it, so long as he was part of the same criminal enterprise as the one who did perpetrate it. RICO prosecution could not only put people behind bars, it could dismantle an entire organization brick by brick, until there was nothing left. And though the law enacted in 1970 was originally created to target traditional mafia, it soon expanded into other realms, becoming a favorite tool of prosecutors gunning for white-collar criminals, such as the network of junk bond traders led by Michael Milken in the 1980s, as well as Ponzi scheme operators, bribe-paying government contractors, and even corrupt police departments. Sitting at a conference table in the United States Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York, overlooking downtown Brooklyn's Cadman Plaza that September afternoon, Berryman rattled off the same list of potential targets that he'd shared with Randall earlier. Then he worked through 8 different criminal statutes he thought could apply to a case involving global soccer. They encompassed a range of potential charges and legal strategies, some fairly novel, but he was particularly excited about one of them, and finally laid it out. "I've done the research," Berryman said, "and I think FIFA is perfect for RICO." The 2 assistant U.S. attorneys sitting across the table from Berryman, Evan Norris and Amanda Hector, were much younger than he was, and they had sat impassively during his presentation, asking few questions. But now Hector, intense and serious, with long chestnut brown hair, frowned and shot Norris a look. RICO was one of the most powerful cudgels the Department of Justice had at its disposal. It had generated some of the most sensational, headline-grabbing prosecutions on record. But the cases weren't easy. Successful racketeering investigations frequently required massive manpower and coordination across multiple agencies. Even the best lawyers had trouble, at times, wrapping their heads around RICO's bewildering complexity. And explaining to a jury the abstract subtleties of a law that made one man responsible for another's crimes was daunting, to say the least. Berryman was clearly taking a leap. "You're kind of getting ahead of yourself, aren't you?" Hector coolly said to Berryman. The agent tried to push down a suddenly swelling feeling of panic. The FBI may have been investigating the case, but it was the U.S. Attorney's Office that ran the show. The prosecutors oversaw the case, and they could decide to invite Berryman to join in, take his ideas and hand them off to the FBI, or a local IRS agent to pursue, or simply ignore them altogether. Scrambling, Berryman looked down at his typed notes and launched into what he hoped would be the most winning portion of his pitch. The challenge with a case like this, he said, was that the vast majority of FIFA officials weren't American. But, he said, eyes growing wide, he knew of at least a half dozen ways to hang fraud, money laundering, and tax charges on foreigners. The key, he explained, is the fact that whenever there's an international wire transfer between banks, even ones in far-flung countries, the money usually flows through American financial institutions. Wire transfers can be made only between banks that have a relationship with one another. And since most of the thousands of banks around the world do not have such relationships, they must rely on so-called correspondent banks to complete the transfers on their behalf. And because the United States is home to so many of the world's largest banks, which have huge networks with other financial institutions around the world, they often act as middlemen correspondent banks. If a soccer official in Qatar wanted to wire a several $100,000 bribe to an official in Trinidad, it's unlikely that their banks transact often enough to make it worth establishing a permanent commercial relationship. On the other hand, it's quite likely that a huge American bank, such as J.P. Morgan Chase, regularly does business with both the Qatari Bank and the Trinidadians Bank, and thus, for a fee, could process the transfer. If not, it's a near certainty that Chase has a relationship with another huge U.S. bank, like Wells Fargo, that in turn works with the Trinidadian Bank. The money in that wire then flows from the Qatari official's bank account, through Chase, then on to Wells Fargo, and finally to the bank account of the corrupt official in Trinidad. It was complicated, Berryman knew. And to help keep the prosecutor's eyes from glazing over, he pulled a blank sheet of paper out of his portfolio, placed it on the table in front of him, and drew a curved line between 2 boxes, representing banks. He then added additional boxes along the span of the arc, representing correspondent banks. He called the whole thing a money transfer rainbow. What the rainbow showed, Berryman said, was that the money passed through the United States. That was critical. It meant criminal jurisdiction could be established for, say, a bribe paid to a member of the FIFA Exco to vote a certain way, even if neither party to the conspiracy was American and their meeting took place in some other country. But that wasn't all. The entire system functioned, Berryman said, adding several more lines to the rainbow, thanks to a handful of electronic wire transfer systems that automate the whole correspondent bank process. Happily, it just so happened that two of the largest wire transfer systems in the world, Fedwire and the Clearinghouse Interbank Payment System, or CHIPS, were based in the U.S., and Berryman had great relationships with both. Instead of blindly hunting down sources they hoped would tell them about bribes, Berryman could easily subpoena Fedwire and CHIPS for a list of international wires involving a possible suspect, such as Julio Grondona, a powerful FIFA vice president from Argentina. Within days, he'd get back a spreadsheet listing every transfer Grondona made or received, as well as the names and account numbers of who sent or received them. Best of all, the tracing could be done in secret, without having to contact foreign banks and running the risk of them informing their clients. The takeaway, Berryman said, was that he could unearth bribe payments he knew absolutely nothing about beforehand, essentially reverse-engineering the entire investigative process. That information could be used to indict people, or to force them to flip and cooperate with the investigation. He paused, and there was a moment of stunned silence in the conference room. It was, from the prosecutor's perspective, a strange and wonderful kind of alchemy being described. Something akin, perhaps, to being handed a pneumatic jackhammer after a lifetime of digging with bare hands. But before either prosecutor could respond, Berryman was at full speed again, reeling off some of his other favorite tricks, including ways to use subpoenas to force individuals to reveal the existence of foreign bank accounts, and one obscure loophole in the federal code that vastly expanded the definition of money laundering. The point, Berryman said, was that he could use all this to help clean up soccer. It didn't matter that he was based in California. He had the knowledge and drive to push this case all the way to the top. If we can get Blazer and Warner, he concluded, we can get Bin Hammam. And if we can get Bin Hammam, we can get Blatter. Berryman looked entreatingly at Norris, the lead prosecutor on the case. He was tall and slender with long, sensitive fingers and a thick mane of black hair, so impeccably combed, it looked as if it were made of molded plastic. He had said almost nothing during the meeting, but Berryman thought he caught something in his eye. Norris seemed to get it. Evan Moran Norris was only 35, but he'd already proven himself to be one of the most talented young prosecutors in the Eastern District of New York. The son of an immigrant from Iran and a high school administrator, he grew up in an intellectual family, moving from city to city as his father got new jobs at private schools in cities like Minneapolis. Along the way, he developed a strong moral sense of right and wrong, and an unwavering confidence in his own opinion. As an undergraduate studying political science at Columbia University, he once wrote a letter to the editor of the student newspaper just to say how concerned I am by the lack of selflessness and compassion shown by the author of an op-ed he found offensive. While at Harvard Law, Norris eschewed the famed and prestigious law review, instead volunteering at the school's legal aid bureau, where he spent as many as 30 hours a week helping needy families deal with legal problems free of charge. He called the clinic, hands down, far and away the best thing I've done at the law school. By the time he graduated, he knew he wanted to be a prosecutor. And after a few years at a big Manhattan law firm, he took a job as an assistant U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York. He was soon assigned to organized crime and revealed himself to be a remarkably careful, measured litigator. Norris played a critical role in convicting a number of Gambino family members, and shone brilliantly in the trial of one of them, a particularly nasty assassin with a predilection for dissolving his victims in vats of acid to hide the evidence. But he wasn't just good in court. His supervisors recognized in Norris a knack for leadership, and soon put him on long-running and highly sensitive investigations involving complicated and often arcane criminal schemes. It was while running one such case, which never produced an indictment, that Norris first worked with Mike Gaeta of the FBI. Gaeta, too, saw in the young prosecutor the ability to run complicated investigations, and thought they had similar philosophies of building a case. which is why he took his rough-hewn idea of going after FIFA to Norris in Brooklyn, rather than someone in the Southern District of New York, based in Manhattan. The SDNY was the highest-profile office in the country, and landed most of the biggest cases, but Gaeta trusted his gut, and thought Norris was the man for the job. Norris was intensely private, almost never letting his feelings outwardly show, but he cared deeply about his work, and developed a degree of personal umbrage at the misdeeds of those he targeted. He believed the people being prosecuted ultimately deserved it, and were personally responsible for their own legal woes. Special agents might be the guys with the guns in their pockets, but a successful criminal investigation goes nowhere without a lead prosecutor who can maintain discipline, see the big picture, think strategically, and above all else, keep calm. A good prosecutor has to write well, have an instinctual feel for the law, think on his feet, and be passionate about winning. But most of all, the job requires judgment. Investigations get blown up by moving too fast, for lack of preparation, or because of reckless mistakes. Convictions, the ultimate goal, depended on making smart decisions about how to run a case and who to bring into it. A few hours after their meeting, Norris called Berryman's cell phone. The IRS agent was standing on the corner of Canal and West Broadway, not far from his hotel. He had been too nervous to sit still since leaving the office in Brooklyn, worried that the prosecutors might just take his ideas and shut him out of the most exciting case he'd ever come across. He had never wanted to be on an investigation as badly as this one, and had been almost unable to sleep in the days leading up to his big presentation. "I'd like to welcome you aboard," Norris said. Berryman's face broke into a wide grin. After hanging up, he walked around Soho, beaming, oblivious to the heat and his uncomfortable suit. Chapter 10 Blazers Money. On July 20, 2000, a federal grand jury in Salt Lake City handed down a 15-count indictment against Thomas K. Welch and David R. Johnson, the former president and vice president of the Salt Lake City Bid Committee for the 2002 Winter Olympic Games. Prosecutors had brought the charges following a lengthy investigation of alleged bribery by the bid committee as part of a successful effort to convince International Olympic Committee members to choose Salt Lake City over competing cities in Sweden, Switzerland, and Canada. They presented evidence that more than $1 million in cash, scholarships, gifts, travel, and even medical care to IOC members had been paid to voters, as well as documentation of efforts to cover up the payments with sham contracts and altered financial reports. Despite what prosecutors believed was a strong case, neither Welch nor Johnson was ever convicted. A year after the indictment, the judge overseeing the case dismissed the bribery counts, and when the case fully went to trial, the judge granted a motion for acquittal by the defense. Afterward, he said the case offended his sense of justice. The IOC case, Berryman thought, with its international bribery and vote buying, had obvious parallels to the soccer investigation, and it had been an unmitigated disaster. If he and his new colleagues in New York were going to take on FIFA, it wouldn't be enough to show that money had changed hands, that officials had been bribed, or that payments had been covered up. They needed to be absolutely solid on every level, and to make sure there were no holes a keen defense lawyer could use to undermine the entire case. No matter how much dirt they dug up, it would mean nothing unless it stuck in court. An indictment involving world soccer, if it ever became public, was clearly going to be high profile, and there would be enormous public attention and pressure on the prosecution. If they picked the wrong law to build their case on, or had a problem with a witness, it could be fatal. Everything had to be by the book, Berryman thought. No mistakes could be made. He'd taken that attitude into his initial meeting in Brooklyn. "Has Chuck Blazer not filed his taxes? Is that why you are here?" the prosecutor Amanda Hector had asked. "What are you seeing?" Berryman had said nothing because he knew that by law, he couldn't discuss the status of a tax return, even with federal prosecutors, until the investigation had been formally expanded to become a tax case by the Justice Department. If he told them, and some clever white-collar attorney ever figured out that he'd done things in the wrong order, it could blow up the whole investigation. Taxes, Berryman well knew, were special. In the wake of Watergate, when it was revealed that the Nixon administration had used tax information about perceived enemies to further its ends, the IRS code was rewritten to enhance privacy protections. One of the principal changes was an amendment to a provision called Section 6103, making tax information strictly confidential unless very rigid restrictions are met. It's the same section that makes it extremely cumbersome, if not impossible, for any law enforcement official other than IRS agents to pull tax returns, even those belonging to targets of a grand jury investigation. Before Berryman could breathe a word about Blazer's tax issues to anyone on the soccer case, he had to get approval from his supervisor in Laguna Niguel, then from criminal tax attorneys in the IRS chief counsel's office in Washington, and finally from the tax division of the Department of Justice. Only then could Berryman call up Norris and say what he had longed to tell him from the moment they met. Chuck Blazer hasn't filed in years, since at least 1994. As he anxiously awaited that moment, Berryman began taking the steps that were necessary to build evidence against Blazer. To charge tax evasion, it wasn't enough to show someone hadn't filed returns. He needed to prove Blazer had willfully hidden income. To start with, Berryman spent hour after hour on the website of journalist Andrew Jennings, which had been credited and linked to in the Reuters article that had drawn him into the case. Berryman had never heard of Jennings, but he was impressed at his deep focus on corruption in soccer. The site had scores of articles about FIFA, tales of skullduggery, chicanery, and outright criminality stretching back to the Avalanche era of the 1970s. It was all fascinating, but Berryman focused on one document Jennings had posted. It was a grainy, low-quality photocopy of both sides of a canceled, year-old check for $205,000 made out to a company called Sportvertising. Berryman enlarged the check on his computer and looked it over. The scan was so bad that some parts, such as the signature, were illegible. But on the backside, he thought he could just make out the handwritten endorsement. He squinted at it, moved his face close to the screen, and even held up a magnifying glass to get a closer look. Finally, he was able to make out the handwriting. It said, Forward Deposit Only, Sportvertising Inc., Merrill Lynch. It felt like a huge break. Berryman had been worried that Blazer might have done all of his banking overseas, which would make getting information about his accounts both difficult and risky. If, as the articles about Blazer suggested, he had accounts in the Cayman Islands or the Bahamas, there were significant legal and diplomatic obstacles to requesting any associated records. And even then, banks in Caribbean tax havens weren't known for their generous disclosure policies. There was also the significant risk that bankers in Cayman or the Bahamas, after reviewing such requests, might decide to reach out to Blazer to tell him the feds were poking around, which could have disastrous results on the case. Alerted to an investigation, Blazer could destroy records, tell other soccer officials, or even flee the country. But Merrill Lynch, the brokerage house and money manager famous for its bull logo, was based in the United States and subject to its laws. That meant Berryman could subpoena Merrill, demanding any and all information about accounts in the name of Sportvertising or Chuck Blazer, monthly statements, lists of transactions, or info on any associated accounts or beneficial owners. And the firm would be legally bound not only to hand it all over, but to keep the request absolutely secret, even from the account holder. So that's exactly what Berryman did. It took him all of 20 minutes. Sunil Gulati considered Chuck Blazer one of his closest friends and mentors. He'd known the man nearly his entire adult life. They'd seen countless soccer matches in each other's company, spent endless hours together on airplanes, and sat through too many meetings to count. And now Gulati had to tell him he was fired. He'd first met Blazer on the sidelines when he was fresh out of college, helping run the all-star teams of the Connecticut Junior Soccer Association while studying for his master's in economics at Columbia. Blazer, 16 years older, was at the time in charge of the all-star select teams in neighboring New York State, and the two collaborated to schedule tournaments and other events. Gulati, passionate about the sport and determined to rise in its ranks, crossed paths with him again when Blazer was elected vice president of the U.S. Soccer Federation, where Gulati sat with him on a committee. They worked together on the 1994 World Cup, for which Gulati served as a vice president. And for several years, while the younger man was a Major League Soccer executive, Blazer loaned him office space, free of charge, inside CONCACAF's Trump Tower offices. In 2007, when a slot opened on the Confederation's executive committee, Blazer helped Gulati win an appointment without having to be elected by the Confederation's full Congress. Gulati, who had been voted in as president of the U.S. Soccer Federation the previous year, had remained on the CONCACAF board ever since. Amid the tumult following Blazer's decision to report Jack Warner and Mohammed bin Hammam to FIFA, Gulati had stood by his old friend. As one of the staunchest supporters of the American bid for a World Cup, Gulati was infuriated by rumors that Warner may have voted for Qatar instead, and, like many in CONCACAF, seemed happy to see him go. But the political winds had shifted since the spring of 2011. CONCACAF's executive committee had never questioned Blazer's financial management, signing off on the Confederation's audited financial statements year after year without comment. After Jennings' articles revealed Blazer's unusually lucrative 10% contract, that tolerant attitude abruptly changed. The CONCACAF Executive Committee, meeting in Panama in August, asked the General Secretary to turn over information about his compensation. Cornered, Blazer said he expected to earn $2 million in 2011 and provided copies of his contracts. The first was the original agreement from 1990, when he was appointed by Warner. The second, from 1994, had essentially the same terms and expired on July 17, 1998. There were no others. In other words, Blazer had been working without a valid contract for more than 13 years, but continued taking his generous commission on nearly everything, regardless. Then, on August 31st, Jack Warner responded to Blazer's claim that the $250,000 check he'd received from the Caribbean Football Union was repayment of a loan. In fact, Warner said, Blazer had received a total of $750,000 from the CFU account, and that it was not a loan because he had never had occasion to borrow money from Blazer, and that the money had originally come from FIFA. Warner added that despite repeated entreaties over many years, Blazer had steadfastly refused to share information about his compensation. Whatever private opinions Gulati and the other officials might have had, the matter was now in the public eye, a glaring embarrassment. CONCACAF's leadership realized it could no longer sit idly by. For months, the Confederation had been trying to elect someone to take Warner's vacant seat on the FIFA Executive Committee, but with large portions of its membership still under investigation for allegedly taking bribes in Port of Spain, that was proving impossible. Meanwhile, the dispute over who would serve as CONCACAF's acting president hadn't been resolved. Although the Confederation's executive committee had installed Alfredo Howitt, its Caribbean membership refused to recognize the Honduran and was outraged about Lyle Austin's year-long ban from FIFA. It was becoming obvious that CONCACAF would have no legitimate president until its elections scheduled for the following May. As for the Caribbean, the CFU was planning its own elections in a few weeks, but there was every indication those would either be called off or end in disaster. CONCACAF, in other words, was in chaos. On October 3rd, Gulati met with the three other members of the CONCACAF Executive Committee in New York. In the face of the building evidence of serious financial impropriety, they saw little alternative but to jettison Blazer. Gulati knew the man best. It would fall on his shoulders to deliver the bad news, which he did in a visit to Blazer's apartment upstairs from the Confederation's offices. His time at CONCACAF was over. Blazer could save face and resign immediately, or be publicly pushed out. It had been a great run, 21 years atop CONCACAF, turning it from a nothing organization into a financial powerhouse, and besides, Blazer would still be sitting on FIFA's executive committee, which was, of course, the best gig in all of soccer. Without Warner to protect him and the Confederation's leadership turning against him, Blazer knew he had little choice, and agreed to go quietly. But he did ask one concession, that he be allowed to stay on as general secretary until year's end. Gulati and the rest of CONCACAF's executive committee were happy to concede that small favor. They asked only that Blazer refrain from making any more payments to himself from CONCACAF accounts until the committee could figure out what, if anything, he was actually owed. 3 days later, Blazer publicly announced his resignation as CONCACAF's general secretary, citing a desire to pursue other career opportunities in the burgeoning industry of international football, and a strong preference for leaving the country to do so. The 2011 Gold Cup had been the most successful ever. More than 1 million people attended the tournament, held in June and July, and the fact that the final was between Mexico and the U.S. guaranteed that its sponsors, such as Miller Lite, went away happy. The tournament contributed to CONCACAF's best financial year ever. For all of 2011, the Confederation had $60 million in revenue, a huge increase from the $37 million it collected in 2009, the prior Gold Cup year. By Blazer's reckoning, his commission was not limited to sponsorship and TV rights fees. Instead, he took his slice of tournament ticket sales, luxury suite income, parking fees, and even the beers and hot dogs sold at stadium concession stands. On almost every dollar that came in, Blazer took 10%, accruing it in an internal count called commissions payable. He even took 10% of development money sent to the Confederation by FIFA, in one instance paying himself $300,000 of a $3 million FIFA grant used to build the television production studio within CONCACAF's Trump Tower offices. At the same time, Blazer had for years charged almost anything he could think of to his corporate American Express card, using it for travel, meals at Elaine's, clothing, gifts, pretty much everything. CONCACAF would pay the Amex bills in full, and then Blazer, once a year, would review his statements and deduct anything he judged to be a personal expense from the commission's payable account. In that way, Blazer never had to pay a dime out of pocket to cover his personal expenses, and at the same time he'd accumulate all the Amex membership points for his personal use. Over a 7-year period, CONCACAF paid $26 million to Amex, which earned Blazer enough points to swap for 200 round-trip first-class tickets from the U.S. to Europe. Blazer did the same thing with his rent. Over the years, he lived in several different apartments in Trump Tower, and since 2001, had occupied two adjoining units on the 49th floor that together cost $18,000 a month. Because Blazer frequently worked out of the apartment and didn't even come down to CONCACAF's 17th floor office on many days, he justified a third of the apartment rental as a home office payable by CONCACAF. The remaining $12,000, he simply deducted from the amounts he had calculated CONCACAF owed him in commissions. Again, not a dime out of pocket. Blazer was an accountant by training. Making the Confederation pay for everything not only saved him money, but also meant there was virtually no paper trail of his income and expenses. Indeed, Blazer made a point of putting as little in his own name as possible. Rather than buy a car, he had CONCACAF purchase a Hummer that only he used. Rather than acquire condos in Miami and the Bahamas, he put them in CONCACAF's name, even though only he had the keys. Dating back to his days selling gewgaws and throwaway promotional items, Blazer had found ways to hide money, setting up a string of shell companies with names like Windmill Promotions and Sandcastle Distributors. Once he got to CONCACAF, he became more sophisticated, registering his companies in Caribbean tax havens where the ownership was almost impossible to determine. His commissions from CONCACAF went directly to his anonymous shell companies, and he insisted that other, less legitimate payments be sent to them as well. As a result, there was little, if any, suggestion that Blazer received any income at all. He had no W-2s, no property tax to pay, not even utility bills. Like Al Capone in the 1920s, Blazer was, from a financial perspective, almost a ghost, which was exactly how a man who hadn't filed income taxes in well over a decade, despite collecting millions of dollars in income during that time, would want it. Blazer was so fixated on leaving no traces that that he even refused to use a loyalty card during his frequent visits to the card tables in Las Vegas casinos, out of concern that the IRS would be alerted to his gambling winnings and audit him. Years of successfully operating under that clandestine system had emboldened Blazer and given him a sense of impunity as he awarded himself ever-expanding sums of money without paying a dime of tax on any of it. If 2011 was CONCACAF's best year ever, then it followed that it would be Blazer's best year as well. By the time Gulati confronted Blazer in early October, the General Secretary had already allocated himself $4.2 million in 2011 commissions. He divided the sum, nearly twice as much as he'd ever paid himself, between two shell companies he'd established years earlier, Multisport Games Development and En Passant Limited. Blazer had promised to leave CONCACAF for good on December 31st. Now, with time atop the institution he had built up from almost nothing dwindling, the General Secretary had one last commission to collect. On November 10th,
Blazer contacted the Confederation's bank in Miami,
BAC Florida Bank, instructing it to wire $1.4 million to his sportvertising account in the Cayman Islands. It was, he wrote in the wire instructions, in payment of Gold Cup commissions. Shortly thereafter, he got an email from his Cayman Islands bank, confirming the money had arrived safely. "Yippee," Blazer replied. Chapter 11. The Flip. The subpoenas started rolling back in before the end of September. At first, just a trickle, and then a torrent, one after the next. For Berryman, it was like Christmas. He'd check his email, and boom, there was another one, with its precise boilerplate legal language and attachments containing row after row of beautiful numbers. From Fedwire and Chips, both based in New York, he'd get spreadsheets of every wire involving a particular account, and peering into the records he could see the originating banks, the correspondent banks, the amount being transferred, and the accounts on the other end of the transfer. Then, if any of the correspondent banks were in the U.S., he'd send out another set of subpoenas, asking each one to cough up information about the transfer, and any other wires it might have handled from that same account. Berryman had a knack for visualizing the flow of money, as if it were a tangible thing, something he could see bouncing from place to place. Sometimes, when he was particularly lucky, he'd come across a wire that started or ended in a domestic bank, and then he could ask for everything, what he called the kitchen sink, down to the names of each signatory to the account, of the beneficial owner, of any other accounts those people had at the same bank, and copies of every monthly statement stretching back years. Then he'd sit and contentedly go through it all, line by line by line. He sent out hundreds of subpoenas in a constant blast. It got to the point where he talked to the employees in the legal departments of the big banks so frequently, they seemed like close personal friends. One in particular, a kind lady who worked for Merrill Lynch in Chicago, had first called him when he was back in New York a second time, for a meeting with the prosecutors in late September. He was just walking down the street, and she serenely started reading off the bank account information over the phone. Berryman felt like he wanted to reach through the phone and hug her. He subpoenaed every FIFA-related name he could think of. Sepp Blatter, Jack Warner, Mohammed bin Hammam, Jerome Valk, on and on. Some would come up dry, but many would turn up something. And when something promising came in, Berryman would upload the document to a folder in a secure server entitled All Transactions, which was accessible to the other agents and prosecutors on the case. As the files piled up, dozens becoming hundreds, Norris taught Berryman a little organizational trick. Put the date of the questionable wire first in the title, being careful to list the year first, then the month, then the day. The result would sound something like this. 2008-12-19, wire from CFU Republic Bank Trinidad to Sportvertising. First Caribbean International Bank for $298,500. That way, as the contents of the shared server grew, each new addition slotted into the larger hole in chronological order, and over time they had created a painstakingly constructed, shareable timeline of apparent financial misdeeds. Then, in early October, the final bureaucratic approvals from Washington had gone through clearing the way for Berryman to tell the rest of the team about Blazer's tax troubles. It gave